Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world. Today on the program, you will hear stories from John Russell, Alice Bryant, and Anne Ball. Later, Steve Ember will bring us today's Making of a Nation report. But first, here is John Russell.
Health workers in Zimbabwe are helping people with mental health problems through a new program. Experts say the treatment could serve as a model for other countries in Africa. Doctors estimate that about 1/4 of Zimbabweans suffer from depression or anxiety. But there are only 12 psychiatrists in the country of 14 million people. Psychiatrists are doctors who treat mental or emotional problems. The University of Zimbabwe, the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, and King's College London worked together to create a new kind of treatment. Dr. Victoria Sims works at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine.
We can't possibly go the route of training psychiatrists and psychologists because it would take 15 years. How are we going to provide treatment?
So, doctors created a simple but effective program. They placed wooden seats, which they call friendship benches, outside several health clinics in the city of Harare. Dr. Sims says people were given the chance to meet on the benches for 6 sessions with health workers. They call these workers grandmother health providers.
So the patient explains what all their problems are, and it's opening up the mind in the sense of allowing the patient to see that they can do something about their problems.
The Friendship Bench study involved more than 550 patients. After 6 months, only 14% of the patients in the Friendship Bench group said they were still depressed. That compares to 50% of those who did not receive treatment. Those who received the treatment were also 5 times less likely to have suicidal thoughts. Dr. Dixon Chibanda is with the University of Zimbabwe. He is one of the founders of the Friendship Bench program. He told VOA that the program has many benefits.
Not only a mental health sort of package, but a package that actually improved outcomes of things like hypertension, diabetes, and adherence to medication for people living with HIV.
Friendship benches are now placed in 60 clinics in Harare and 2 other cities. The Canadian government is helping to pay for the program's expansion through its Grand Challenges Canada aid program. Researchers say the program could be a model for mental health efforts in poor areas as well as in wealthier countries. I'm John Russell.
Khan Lab School is bringing back the one-room model to teach young students in Mountain View, California. The school is a laboratory for an experimental kind of learning. Silicon Valley, known for its technology companies, is also the birthplace of the school. 12-year-old Michelle Junaid loves the Khan Lab School's untraditional methods.
When I wake up in the morning, I want to wake up, unlike at my last school where I'd want to sleep in and not go to school.
Junaid and her sister's reactions to the school surprise their parents. The girl's father, Junaid Qureshi, told VOA, "Our children, they love going to school, to the point that even if they are sick or have the flu, they will not stay home from school. To the point that we worry why kids come home so happy. Are they really learning things?" Students ages 5 to 15 attend the experimental Khan Lab School. It has no grade levels and no homework. The students are in school from 8:30 in the morning until 6 o'clock at night. And the school is open all year long, with small breaks here and there. 9-year-old Holly Thompson enjoys going there.
Then you get to choose what you learn, and it's not just a teacher hands you a worksheet and tells you to do it. You get to set your own goals, you have a schedule, you go to different classes.
The school is the idea of Salman Khan, the founder of Khan Academy, famous for its educational videos. The videos are available on the internet, free of charge, and have millions of users around the world. Khan said he started Khan Lab School because he thinks the current education system has problems. He hopes to create a better learning model.
Where I see the future going is somewhat revisiting the past. There was a lot of really good things about the one-room schoolhouse that you might have had in rural areas, and you still have today in a lot of places, where you have mixed-age classrooms.
He said this system lets the older students take responsibility and help younger students. That means the younger children get a lot of help. They get the help of the teacher and the older students. Khan said students also learn the study material at their own speed through videos, and they get more attention through one-on-one discussions with teachers. They also learn by doing projects. Malika Junaid noted a change in her daughters after they began attending the school. She said that after 6 months, they seemed sure of their abilities. They are now not afraid to talk to adults and other students, and now they always want to help. The school's director, Dominic Lichty, said this way of learning better prepares students for the future. He said the duties of a teacher need to change from leading the class to being someone who guides students in their learning and provides individual support. A teacher is also a lifelong learner, he said, not just someone who gives presentations. Lichty also said the role of students is becoming more creative. Salman Khan describes his Khan Lab School as a work in progress. Like a R&D lab, the first time that you make the drug or the first time that you make the material, Khan said, it's not scalable yet, but you need to make it the first time and say, that's a pretty strong material, and then you can think about how do you make it so that it's more affordable and more scalable. Dominic Lichty says the community in the Mountain View area has been open to this new method to educating students, especially in Silicon Valley, because that's the culture that you can start something, he said. You can pioneer something, and people join that movement, and I feel that amongst my staff. Lichty says he has that same feeling amongst his students and members of the community. I'm Alice Bryant.
Liver cancer is the sixth most common cancer in the world. And now, researchers are developing new forms of treatment. If tests show you have liver cancer, there are several ways to treat the disease. One is removing the cancerous part of the liver. The other is having doctors replace the organ through a transplant operation. Patients who get someone else's liver must take immunosuppressant drugs the rest of their life. The drugs keep the body from rejecting the new organ. There may be serious side effects that come with taking those powerful medicines. Chemotherapy and radiation treatments are also used to treat liver and other cancers. Those treatments require the patient to take strong drugs or exposure to radiation. The drugs or radiation destroy the cancer cells, but then the healthy cells around the tumor are damaged. Now, scientists are working on an experimental treatment. They say it reduces the chances of harming the patient. This treatment involves the use of natural, non-poisonous chemicals from plants. That is why the researchers call it a green method for fighting cancer. Katish Kati is a professor of radiology and physics at the University of Missouri's School of Medicine. For more than 10 years, he has studied the use of nanotechnology to fight cancer. For this study, Kati used extremely small objects to target and destroy precancerous tumor cells in the livers of mice and human cells in the laboratory. Kati used very small particles of gold. The gold was covered in a protective material called gum arabic. He says the particles attract precancerous and cancer cells. Those cells are far more affected by lower levels of heat than healthy cells. Once the particles travel to and connect with the cells, they are heated with a laser. That destroys the cancer cells, but the healthy ones around them live. Chemotherapy drugs often are toxic. While they kill off the cancer tumors, they are also poisonous to the healthy cells, and the patient can get very sick. Kati says the cost of treatment will be low because 1 gram of gold can be used to treat 50 patients. The next step is testing in human subjects. If this treatment method works, it will be good news for the nearly 800,000 people who are found to have liver cancer every year. It may also help save the lives of some 700,000 people who die every year from the disease. More than 80% of the liver cancer cases are found in less developed countries. with the highest numbers in Asia and Africa. In the United States, liver cancer is one of the top 10 cancers that kill. I'm Anne Ball.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. Today we continue the story of America's 36th president, Lyndon Baines Johnson. Johnson was vice president to John F. Kennedy. Kennedy was murdered in Dallas in November of 1963. Johnson served the last 14 months of the president's term. Then he won a full term of his own starting in January 1965. Most of Johnson's time and energy would be taken up by the war in Vietnam. By early 1964, America had about 17,000 troops in Vietnam. The troops were there to advise and train the South Vietnamese military. Vietnam had gained its independence from France in 1954. The country was divided into North and South. The North had a communist government led by Ho Chi Minh. The South had an anti-communist government led by Ngo Dinh Diem. In 1957, communist rebels, the Viet Cong, launched a violent campaign in the South. They were supported by the government of North Vietnam and later by North Vietnamese troops. Their goal was to overthrow the government in the South. President Johnson believed that the United States had to support South Vietnam. Many Americans agreed. They believed that without American help, South Vietnam would become communist. There were concerns about the so-called domino theory, that if South Vietnam fell, other Southeast Asian countries would also fall to communists. As Johnson began his full term, his military advisors told him the communists were losing the war. They told him that North Vietnamese troops and Viet Cong forces would soon stop fighting. On February 6, 1965, however, the Viet Cong attacked American camps at Pleiku and Quinon. The Johnson administration immediately ordered airstrikes against military targets in the North. Some observers in the United States questioned the administration's policy. James Reston of the New York Times, for example, said President Johnson was carrying out an undeclared war in Vietnam. In March 1965, the first American combat troops arrived in South Vietnam. Congress supported the president's actions at that time. However, the number of Americans who opposed the war began to grow. These people said it was a civil war. They said the United States had no right or reason to intervene. For 6 days in May, the United States halted bombing of North Vietnam. The administration hoped this would help get the North Vietnamese government to begin negotiations. The North refused, and the United States began to build up its forces in the South. By July, 125,000 Americans were fighting in Vietnam. Some Americans became angry. Anti-war demonstrations took place in San Francisco and Chicago. more and more students began to protest. They wanted the war to end quickly. Some people thought the anti-war demonstrations were only delaying peace in Vietnam. James Reston believed the demonstrations would make Ho Chi Minh think America did not support its troops. And that, he said, would only make him continue the war. In December of 1965, the United States again halted its air campaign against North Vietnam. Again, it invited the North Vietnamese government to negotiate an end to the fighting. And again, the North refused. Ho Chi Minh's conditions for peace were firm. He demanded an end to the bombing and a complete American withdrawal. Withdrawal would mean defeat for the South. It would mean that all of Vietnam would become communist. President Johnson would not accept these terms, so he offered his own proposals. The most important was an immediate ceasefire. Neither side would compromise, however, and the fighting went on. In 1966, President Johnson renewed the bombing in North Vietnam. He also increased the number of American troops in South Vietnam. ...1966 was also a year for congressional elections. The opposition Republican Party generally supported the war efforts of Lyndon Johnson, who was a Democrat. But it criticized him and other Democrats for economic problems connected to the war. The war cost $2 billion every month. The price of many goods in the United States began to rise. The value of the dollar began to drop. Americans faced inflation and then a recession. To answer the criticism, administration officials said progress was being made in Vietnam, but some Americans began to suspect that the government was not telling the truth about the war. Opposition to the war led to bigger and bigger demonstrations. In July 1967, just over half the people questioned for opinion surveys said they did not approve of the president's policies. But most Americans believed that Johnson would run again for president the next year. Johnson strongly defended the use of American troops in Vietnam. In a speech to a group of lawmakers, he said, "Since World War II, this nation has met and has mastered many challenges. Challenges in Greece and Turkey, in Berlin, in Korea, in Cuba. We met them because brave men were willing to risk their lives for their nation's security. And braver men have never lived than those who carry our colors in Vietnam at this very hour." The price of these efforts, of course, has been heavy. But the price of not having made them at all, not having seen them through, in my judgment, would have been vastly greater. Then came Tet, the Vietnamese Lunar New Year, in January 1968. The communists launched a major military campaign. They attacked 31 of the 44 provinces of South Vietnam. They also struck at the American embassy in the capital, Saigon.
Military police got back into the compound of the $2.5 million embassy complex at dawn. Before that, a platoon of Viet Cong were in control. The communist raiders never got into the main chancery building. A handful of Marines had it locked and kept them out. But the raiders were everywhere else.
CBS News reporter George Sievertson described more of the fighting in Saigon and how it affected civilians in a poor part of the city.
This neighborhood is called the Chessboard because of the maze of alleys and passageways. Its residents are mostly poor working people, and its slums are a refuge for Saigon's hoodlum and criminal elements. Vietnamese Rangers and Marines move carefully, blasting buildings and possible Viet Cong hiding places before moving ahead. This was the first time heavy fighting has taken place in Saigon proper. Until now, most of it has been in the Chinese section of Cho Lan and in the suburbs. The VC were difficult to dislodge. They obviously knew the section well and had built barricades in key spots. The Rangers and Marines took casualties, mostly from hidden snipers. As soon as the section had been cleared, more terror-stricken civilians scurried out of their homes, thousands of them fleeing from the bullets and explosives, and even more dangerous, a fire that began to rage out of control. Residents in nearby buildings began dragging their most precious possessions out of their shops and homes. Saigon's water supply system is operating only at 70% of normal, so fires are a serious menace. For these people, many of them who fled the war from outlying villages, this is the cruelest blow. The curfew has kept them from making a living. Food prices have tripled since the fighting began a week ago. And now, their homes are being destroyed.
Thousands of people were killed in the Tet Offensive. The Communists suffered heavier losses than the South Vietnamese or the Americans. But many Americans were surprised that the Communists could launch such a major attack against South Vietnam. For several years, they had been told that Communist forces were small and losing badly. General William Westmoreland, commander of U.S. military operations in Vietnam, spoke with reporter George Sievertson.
General, how would you assess yesterday's activities and today's? What is the enemy doing? Are these major attacks or...
The enemy, very deceitfully, has taken advantage of the Tet Truce in order to create maximum consternation within South Vietnam, particularly in the populated areas. Now, yesterday, the enemy exposed himself by virtue of this strategy, and he suffered great casualties.
As a result of the offensive, popular support for the administration fell even more. Democrats who opposed President Johnson seized this chance. Several ran against him for the party's nomination in 1968. These included Senator Robert Kennedy of New York and Senator Eugene McCarthy of Minnesota. Kennedy and McCarthy did well in the early primary elections. Johnson did poorly. At the end of March 1968, the president spoke to the American people. He discussed his proposal to end American bombing of North Vietnam. He talked about his appointment of a special ambassador to start peace negotiations. And he announced his decision about his own future.
I do not believe that I should devote an hour or a day of my time to any personal partisan causes or to any duties other than the awesome duties of this office, the presidency of your country. Accordingly, I shall not seek and I will not accept the nomination of my party for another term as your president.
Another major issue facing America in the 1960s was the civil rights movement, which sought to ensure equal rights for black Americans. That will be our story next week. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us again next week for The Making of a Nation.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.